sing, cause I know how it feels. I know how it feels to be free. Yeah, yeah, I know how it feels. Yes, I know how it feels. How it feels to be free.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and worldwide at kpfk.org.
This is Ralph Nader, and you're listening to Radio Powered by the People, KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara, and across the globe at kpfk.org.
And everybody, welcome to the People's Game, and Alan Minsky here, and we have a packed show, and we just lost a few minutes because having a hard time getting our great guest from England on the phone, and we sent him a Zoom invite, and hopefully David Goldblatt will be joining us, if we can open up the Zoom and have David on. Mel, have you sent him the message? And please pot up Melissa Figueroa, my co-host here. And this is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined by my co-host, Melissa Figueroa. We have the preeminent historian of soccer, David Goldblatt, is going to be joining us. And David is the author of The Ball is Round and a number of other seminal works on the history of soccer. And David is also somebody who teaches at Pitzer College right out in the Inland Empire. And he's been a frequent guest on The People's Game in our quadrennial shows over the years. And he's been prominent in the international media, commenting on the World Cup during this cycle. And we'll be talking to him in just a second or so. And we're going to be also joined by comedian Ron Placone, who's a great soccer fan. People might remember the name from when he was on the Jimmy Dore show regularly here on KPFK. And he'll be joining us in the second hour. And Melissa Figueroa is going to join us. And we're also going to be joined by Josh Peschtolt from UTLA to talk about the call, a little bit of home news here about the call for the L.A. Dodgers to not attend the meeting at the Trump White House. Has David joined via Zoom? Not yet. And Mel, maybe if you could call up David, if you can, on the number I gave you, too, and see if you can reach him. But that number was not going through from our phone here. Mel, are you with me? Oh, okay. Let's go back to the music right now, and I'll be right back. Hi, Mel. And so, Mel, why don't you give your thoughts on the World Cup games of the past few days and the politics of the game as it's been going on. And David is joining us, too. So, David Goldblatt, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm so sorry. We had a hard time connecting with you. The phone from the KPFK studios would just go busy. I don't know why that is.
No worries, dude. Here we are.
Here we are, indeed. And I'm so happy to have you here. And I have got so many questions for you, and then a real surprise announcement and to an idea to bounce off of you at the end of our dialogue. And I'm joined by my co-host, Melissa Figueroa, who's on the phone. And
hello.
And then I have another also big theoretical question for you at the end of this. But just to start, you know, I heard your long interview with the CBC at the top of the World Cup, and the themes that you highlighted across that interview of placing the 2026 FIFA World Cup tournament in the broader history of soccer and even the broader history of, let's say, modern or capitalist era spectacle. How do you see that now that we're going into the final week of the tournament? How have your thoughts shifted, or are they pretty much in line with what you were articulating at that time?
What I think after a month of this World Cup, which has been simultaneously appalling and utterly entrancing, is what an extraordinary thing football is. You know, there were, at the beginning of the World Cup, lots of reasons to think it an unpleasant spectacle. You know, the long charge sheet, be it, you know, tickets or parking, an exclusion, or visa issues for teams and players of colour. All of that stuff has been in action. And, you know, FIFA have worked hard in some ways to make the spectacle even more unpleasant. Hydration breaks that are advertising breaks. You know, the endless cutaways to Infantino with some head of state or motley selection of anonymous TikTok influencers. And I understand, actually, it's a contractual obligation for the broadcasters to cut away to him once in each half and not when he is on his phone. I know also that those pictures are not shown inside the stadiums. You know, so you've got all of that. And then you've got, you know, Trump himself in full kind of reverse Midas mode. Everything he touches, you know, turns to shit. And, you know, he, what's so interesting there for me is that he really hasn't known how to play and he can't get a handle on it. You know, the fumbling, bumbling, aggressive, you know, pursuit of the red card, of course, just turned everybody against the United States and gave the Belgians the opportunity to, you know, take the mickey out of him in the most hysterical way. So it's been ugly, but there is something extraordinary about football and football culture that provides moments of resistance and challenge and pleasure. And I've been just sort of living both of those, you know, alongside each other.
Yeah, no, it's astonishing because the you know, FIFA delivers, you know, on some level, you have to cut out a lot of stuff now, but still a somewhat pristine spectacle. You know, the games start right on time, except when they're in Mexico City, they start an hour late. And the sport itself and the passions of the people around the world for the sport and the players, unrivaled.
Isn't that the thing?
Yeah.
That, you know, in the end, it's not really their World Cup. They might be organizing it and they think they're calling all the shots. But a lot of the time, what we're enjoying, what we're reveling in, is kind of ourselves. I mean, how much have we all enjoyed, you know, the bacchanalian public charm of the Scotland fans, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not about FIFA. That's about amity, about friendship, about, you know, just the hedonism of the moment. I think, you know, everybody's been enjoying that loving. Or the sort of unusual and really surprising kind of cross-cultural moments. Who would have thought that, you know, the folks of a town in Kansas would have fallen in love with Algerians? Or that, you know, the people of Tijuana are singing, you know, Iranians are Mexicans, they are our brothers, because America has excluded, in effect, Iran, you know, across the border. So I think while FIFA, you know, FIFA sure know how to organise a tournament, and they know how to run a very kind of rapacious, extractive business model. But so much of the joy is really, it's about us, and it's about the kind of global football public. Or, you know, just another strand of that would be the vulgarity, particularly in the Anglosphere of men's football culture, has produced some of the most hysterical chanting.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with all of those, both from, you know, English fans, I think the Scots, the Australians. I suspect one of the reasons that's kind of keeping Trump out of the stadium is he knows what he's going to hear. And it's great, like, he's a vulgar populist, and it's great sometimes to fight fire with fire. So I think that's been a fantastic thing. And again, that's not just about FIFA, not to detract from the players at all, who, of course, provided, you know, often sensational entertainment and incredible, epic sort of storylines. And when I say entertainment, I think it's slightly too glib. You know, there's more at stake and there's more going on. And football's capacity to nurture complicated, intricate, hysterical, and such a great variety of dramatic forms and theatrical genres, I think it's been very good, this tournament.
It has indeed. Melissa Figueroa, David Goldblatt, Melissa Figueroa is up in Humboldt County organizing the resistance. Melissa Figueroa, your thoughts from what David said.
Yeah, I think it's been a hell of a wild ride, and it's been kind of interesting, especially in this last week and a half or so. You know, not only I think has the World Cup kind of united the rest of the world in the joy of football and everything that you said, which is, again, like there's no other rehearsal for keeping contradictory things in tension than watching the World Cup sometimes. But also, I think even the scandals, the red card scandal, and now, you know, it's kind of united the world to really look at FIFA as like a, almost like an avatar for the global corruption that is happening all over the world, you know, against the oligarchic class. And apparently recently has united people, the world against Argentina for reasons that, you know, it also makes me sad because this is, I feel like, you know, Messi's been in a form that we haven't seen for a while. And it, you know, it's sad that these scandals are kind of throwing a shadow on that. But yeah, I'm wondering about what you think about the sort of, you know, it's not just from the red card, but the proliferation of scandals that have been going on, including last night with that call against Mbolo. So who, you know, also was not even let into the United States until a couple of days before the tournament. So I'm wondering about your thoughts about that and how, you know, that's kind of reflecting the sort of growing anger against the oligarchic class in general and how the World Cup is focusing that.
Great questions. Let me take conspiracy theory first and then FIFA second. I mean, on all of the conspiracies, and I do think they're conspiracies, you know, this is modern football. We have VAR, you know, we have an assumption and a demand for accuracy and endless correctness in a game that is full, whose rules are inherently subjective and open to a call, and in sort of a febrile atmosphere. I mean, I trust literally no football fan to make the right call when looking at a refereeing decision, and least of all the coaches of teams. One of the most excellent things actually about this World Cup for me has been moments on RefCam, where you see the speed and complexity and impossibility of doing what referees do at that speed with people who know how to fool you, where you're trying to have your eyes in five places at once. So I think the refereeing, there have been a few egregious errors and there have been some poor decisions made, but I think on balance refereeing's been pretty good actually, and with a kind of preference for keeping the game flowing for the most part. So I don't buy the conspiracy theories myself. On FIFA, yes. I mean, it's Infantino's had a very long honeymoon. The Blatter era was so awful and so comprehensively trashed by the events of 2015 and the scandals and the court cases that followed, that he's had a very kind of clean slate to play with. And I now think he started making enemies, and I now think he's in trouble. The global public, as well as football administrators, recognise that the kind of dictatorship that's been operating at FIFA, with no opposition, I mean, he's just been completely running the show for the last 8 years. And I think at first I just wondered whether it was kind of cynical gameplay to kind of the way he operated with Trump and other oligarchs, because you have to deal with these people. But I really think he's just drunk the Kool-Aid and gone over, you know, gone over to the dark side. So now is a moment. I mean, if this World Cup can have a really important legacy, it will be that there is sufficient anger and organisation and pressure to force FIFA to be reformed. I mean, I'm currently part of a campaign called Reboot FIFA, organised by the NGO Fair Square, which is calling for the European Parliament, amongst others, to start passing legislation to actually bring FIFA and UEFA within the ambit of some kind of regulation and to force a degree of transparency. I mean, there are a number of court cases and other challenges that the European Parliament is mounting on this. So that's the thing I would say on that. Yes, it's a disgrace and it's time for change. And, you know, in the past, people have assumed that nothing can be done. Where do you even begin with FIFA to try and regulate and control it? How do you even control and democratise football federations, which FIFA is made of? But now there is an option. So I'm encouraged I'm encouraged by this moment because it's an opportunity for some real change. You know, because FIFA only hold football in trust for the rest of us. It's not theirs, you know, and it deserves better. We all deserve better than this.
What are your thoughts now about how the expanded tournament was pulled off? What are your thoughts about the three host nations? What are your thoughts about the United States being allowed to host it? Obviously, we're still the global hegemon, however longer, much longer that's the case. But we are, and so it's not surprising that where Russia is banned for invading Ukraine, us bombing and initiating a war against twice within a year against one of the participant nations, and then treating them terribly and unfairly in terms of the competition. The United States not being sanctioned by FIFA, and then Israel not being sanctioned by FIFA. Your thoughts on all of that, again, as we're a week left in the tournament.
48 teams I was against, and I still think probably it's hard to imagine really what a kind of sustainable World Cup looks like anyway, and 48 does feel like a problem. On the other hand, there's absolutely no doubt that what the joys of this World Cup have been from seeing Cape Verde and Curaçao and teams that might well not have been around to have their moment. And that has been totally fantastic. I did give myself over in the initial stages just to the mad kind of hedonistic rush of games.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said for that. And I thought I would be exhausted by this point. I think I was during Qatar 2022 with fewer games, but somehow I'm not. So I think we have a lot of difficult questions to think about air travel and numbers and carbon around 48. But in terms of narrative and spectacle, it's been unambiguously great. As hosts, I mean, if this competition was about, you know, hosting, like Mexico are definitely the champions.
Yes.
You know, thank you, Mexico,
yes,
for showing everybody what, like, really it really ought to look like and sound like. And it has been magnificent. And not, of course, you know, I'm not not through rose-tinted spectacles. Mexico's got its issues, but it was great that it could accommodate debate about, you know, the disappeared and teachers' wages and a whole bunch of other stuff and still completely freak out and love the World Cup. And I think the game played between England and Mexico at the Azteca, like, that's what it's meant to be like. I thought that was absolutely stunning as a sporting and social and cultural moment. I thought it was ecstatic, and I had the great pleasure of having friends inside the Azteca kind of call me up and play me the noise from inside it while it was going on. So, you know, thank you, Mexico. Totally brilliant. I wish there had been more games there. I think it's been a great moment for Canada. I think the hosting, it didn't quite sort of like explode in the same way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, great. Like, how amazing to see the new Canada. I mean, I've just been in Toronto for a few days, and I was just blown away by the diversity of the city. And it's just like, really, everybody's in Toronto. I could be from Toronto. I mean, it was ridiculous. And it felt, I mean, again, don't want to go rose-tinted here, but it felt like a place that was pretty at ease with that. And to see a different kind of Canada from the sort of Canada you would see demographically anyway, say it's in its ice hockey teams, I thought that was really fantastic, and good on them for going so far, and that was great. And then the United States, well, it's, you know, it's a mixed bag, isn't it? I mean, there are many Americas, I mean, which the rest of the world really needs to learn and understand. So, you know, in New York, you've got lotteries for cheap tickets and great grassroots events and, like, brilliant celebrations of diasporas, you know, which is at complete odds with what you're getting from Washington and the federal government. And I think that, you know, America's immigrants, you know, have been part of, again, the pleasure of the tournament, the Colombians and the Brazilians and the Ecuadorians. I mean, of course, there are people traveling. There's a lot of American Ecuadorians there. And I thought the same, you know, who knew there were so many Congolese folk in Houston? Like, what a thing. And there they all are watching the football. Or, you know, so many Bosnians in Toronto or Iraqis. I mean, tens of thousands. No, I'm a regular visitor to Pitzer College in Claremont in Southern California. So I know I'm familiar with the many other Americas. And it was cool. You know, people... It's good to see all of that. The federal government and Trump, what can you do? It's like, what, we didn't know already? I mean, we know what this dude is like. There's no bottom. So no surprises.
Well, I have a few thoughts on that in a few minutes. But Mel, and we're going to let David go in about 14 minutes. And I have two major questions for him to wrap, but... The floor is yours, Ms. Figueroa.
I think maybe this is an extension from the last question, but also, you know, we've got four teams left. We are going into the very critical semifinals. I just want to get your thoughts on the final four and what might be your prediction to win the whole thing.
So, I had a bet on the World Cup. It's pretty much the only bet I have, you know, once every 4 years. And I went in 2018. I had $10 on France, and in Qatar 2022, I had $10 on Argentina. And this time, I wanted to go all $10 on England, but I ended up going each way. So I'm still sticking with that. I think England are going to beat Argentina and they're going to make the final. I think France are going to beat Spain and I think France are going to beat England. I mean, at least kind of 8 times out of 10. So that's, you know, something else may happen, but that's how I'm seeing it. I'm absolutely loving France. I mean, they are the kings. They are magnifique. You know, the way they carry themselves on the pitch and off the pitch, the way they play is absolutely sensational. You know, they are as close to a high-level Champions League club side with all of the advantages of familiarity and training that one would have that I've seen at a World Cup, I would say. The forward line is incredible. Michael Olise's balance and grace is giving me just enormous pleasure. I mean, the dude is like a dancer, and yet he's moving a ball at his feet and is capable of toughing it out with the Paraguayans. I mean, I must say the game with Paraguay was, I so enjoyed it. Every World Cup needs a game like that. I don't know if you're familiar with the term we use in England to describe the gamesmanship of the Paraguayans, but we would call it shithousery, and that was an absolute masterclass of it. And the French showed that they could deal with that as well. So I thought that was that's brought me a lot of pleasure. Spain are great to watch, a little bit soulless maybe for me. I find it hard to get excited about them. Obviously, their technical and tactical awareness is just, you know, off the scale. Hard to get excited. Argentina, you know, it's Messi is an extraordinary, extraordinary human being, and there have been flashes of that that have helped them get to where they are. I think England, you know, have the making of them, and I'll just say for myself that this is the most multicultural England team you've ever seen. There are more players of colour than ever in this team. Mm-hmm. And this is a really perilous moment in the politics of ethnicity and citizenship and nation in Britain. And it's a fantastic moment to go out and show the racists and fascists and the complacent people who still think we're in 1951 or something, that this is England. this is what England looks like,
you know?
And I'm not just demographically, but I mean, the heart that these folks are playing with. I noticed that, you know, Uber patriot Tommy Robinson has been taking money from Elon Musk to go and network with Russian oligarchs, you know, and they're the patriots. I mean, this is the other England on the pitch. And the sort of heart and the sort of solidarity that that they've shown, and with a German manager, I mean, it couldn't really be better. you know, there's no way that they can co-opt, you know, or turn or bend this to their kind of evil purposes. And that's, I feel quite emotional about it. I mean, it's a really, you know, it's really interesting. In the last, you know, 20 years, when England are at the World Cup, the whole country's been awash with St. George crosses, you know, on cars, on car mirrors, in people's windows. And because the fascists, you know, monopolized that space earlier in the year with their ugly placement of Union Jacks and St. George flags backed by billionaire money on lampposts all over the country as a statement of racist exclusion, everybody has been feeling very iffy about putting flags up. And this is just a sensational moment to take it back from those people. So that is, that sort of, you know, for me, that's what's at stake. I mean, this team can not just make sporting history, they can actually make history and really make a change. And like, I mean, whatever happens, we love them. But there is something amazing potentially brewing for this team. I mean, France have had these moments, you know, and maybe they're going to have another one. But we've yet to have that moment, and maybe it's our time.
Well, of course, there's so much there to talk about. Olise, of course, raised almost entirely in England, choosing to play for the French national team when he could play also for Algeria or Nigeria, but choosing to play for France. And Marie Le Pen, of course, becoming, well, her conviction was upheld at the very same time the courts announced her eligibility to run for president. And, of course, the National Front's relationship to the French national team has been a politically potent issue in recent
years. And the Spanish, the ex-Spanish prime minister, I know, just absolutely outrageous. What's he called? Rajol? Who has, you know, made the same usual, not really a French team. I mean, like, what the hell?
Right.
You know, who are you to speak on this subject? I mean, the same with that terrible Paraguayan senator. Who, you know, called Mbappe a colonized Cameroonian. I mean, it's in some ways, you know, it's really tough on the players, like who wants to have to deal with this stuff.
Right.
But boy, does it flush the scumbags out, you know?
It should have. So a number of things I want to bring up, and I do have to note, though, there's so many things I'd love to ask you about. We are live on air. If this was a pre-record for just the podcast, I could talk to you all day. Love to hear your thoughts on Wonderwall replacing the Neil Diamond song. But I thought it was amazing.
Well, I've got very strong thoughts on that. I'm not a huge Oasis fan, but I am deeply and profoundly grateful that Sweet Caroline has been displaced. I mean, I would say, others might differ, you know, the natural location of Sweet Caroline is as a stomping drunken song at a very white estate agent's wedding somewhere in Surrey.
Yeah, no,
that is where it belongs.
And whatever one makes of the young Mr. Gallagher, the guy who wasn't the singer but the songwriter, and his whatever he was reflecting on to produce the lyrics, they, you know, they're more emotive. And they sort of bring a bond of some depth in as it's sung back and forth between the audience.
You know, it's like, come on, like you can't have American kind of pop, you know, upbeat sort of Neil Diamond pop. I mean, of course it needs to be Oasis. I mean, I think we should change the national anthem.
Well, yes, but I thought I almost started crying when they broke then immediately into Hey Jude, the Na Na Na's for Jude Bellingham, and he responded directly to it. And
sensational. I mean, I think it should be the national anthem.
Which one? Like, Hey Jude or Wonderwall?
No, Hey Jude. Oh, come on. Like, I love Oasis, but really, it's got to be the Beatles.
Sure. The band that Oasis copped all the riffs from, so.
I really just, I don't know if you've noticed, the squad, like all of us, are really struggling to remember to sing God Save the King. Everybody's still going, quit the chain.
Okay. We only have a few moments left, and I have something. Okay. We may try to reach you, David, and invite you back to something. I'm going to be in dialogue with the folks over at The Nation, Dave Zirin, Pacifica. I'm interested possibly in pulling together some kind of panel around the subject of sports spectacle and solidarity. And to be honest, the inspiration came off of the public response in Mamdani's New York to the Knicks victory. And again, the question would be, you know, what utility is there for spectacle sports as an organizing instrument for the left, the pursuing that could be cringeworthy, it could be self-defeating, but it was resonant in New York City, especially with Trump's appearance and the way that played out with the Knicks victory.
Sure, man. And so, you've got to go, you know, the left has got to get it. You've got to go where people are.
Right.
And that's where they are. And, you know, it's rare enough to see kind of, you know, those kind of solidarities and that kind of level of human joy, which is the space in which utopian thoughts and possibilities can actually be nurtured. And boy, are we in need of that.
Oh, boy.
So I think it's a really, really rich territory. One, of course, you know, that is also a minefield of its own. But yes, the possibilities are very significant.
And along those lines, and here's the thing I'm going to announce on air, and in our comic, Ron Placone will be joining us, and he hopefully is listening in, will hear this. We'll reintroduce it when he's introduced. I have the idea, David, and it's a harebrained scheme, and it's not exactly the right audience for it, but what do you think about this? You take cardstock, you know, old-fashioned at like a copy shop, and it's the same color, not as a yellow card, but of a red card, 8.5 by 11. You cut it up into four different quadrants, and you get 80,000 of them, and you distribute them to everybody going into the Meadowlands. I think this should be the People's Game red card. And when Donald Trump takes center stage to hand off the FIFA World Cup trophy to the team that wins, all 80,000 people, and hopefully 800 million people around the world, raise their red cards for Donald Trump. Your thoughts on
Oh, man, I'm all for a red card for Donald Trump. I mean, they pulled this stunt in Zimbabwe against Mugabe back in the day.
Hear, hear.
So, yeah, I'm all for it. I mean, he's familiar enough with the meaning he used with red card. So
he just learned, you know, it, right?
Let's do it.
Yeah, there we go.
If you haven't got a card, you know, it could be some other object. Well, you know, that would be fine.
Herein, though, sadly, look, to have that be a possibility even, I think you sort of have to root for England. I actually don't see, looking at the Argentinian partisans there, I'm guessing they're a little bit more with Malay than they are with the left. And I think we'd have no problem with the English, Spanish, or French fans pulling that off. But I worry about the Argentinians there.
I think that's true. You may struggle with those guys.
David Goldblatt, you have the career I wish I had. You are so lucky and blessed to do this incredibly deep thinking about the subject I can never get my mind off of. I view global football as something that has saved my life over and over again. Not that I'm the suicidal or even that much of a depressive type, but it just brings me such joy that I can't imagine my life without it. You're just the preeminent historian of the most popular spectacle in the world. David Goldblatt, the author of many books. The Ball is Round is, I suppose, viewed as something of your masterpiece. So people should check it out. And thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much. Been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Thank you. And I'll be in touch if we do that a roundtable with The Nation. Okay? Thank you.
Let me know.
Yep, for sure. Thank you. And we're going to go straight now to our next guest. And we're going to take a little break from the most popular spectacle in the world to what was the most popular sport in the United States, and arguably actually the first sport that really trailblazed spectacle sports at a national level, which is baseball. And here in Los Angeles, I think the analog to the New York Knicks are the Los Angeles Dodgers. I think there was very much a political subtext to the victory, the celebrations around the Dodgers' second consecutive World Series victory after a year of ICE raids, etc. I think the expression of the people of Los Angeles, it was very inflected by that. And who better to tell us about a campaign asking the Dodgers not to attend the White House to accept the invitation from Donald Trump to visit the White House, as is often the case with Major League Baseball, NBA, and NFL championship teams. And we're joined by Josh Peschtolt from UTLA fame. Josh, tell us about this campaign.
Thank you very much. And thanks for saying UTLA fame. I was actually, after that, the president of the California Federation of Teachers.
Ah.
So I don't want to leave them out.
Nope. Can't do that.
Well, as LA fans may know, the Dodgers announced a few days ago that they're planning to go to the White House. I think they've set a date, the 23rd of July. They went last year when Trump was in the White House. People were very disappointed. But now we have a whole year of the population really seeing what Trump is about, ICE raids, positioning people, ICE agents in front of Dodger Stadium, killing people, this racist attack on black people, people of color generally. And the Dodgers seem to be tone deaf to all of this stuff. When in fact, when you go to Dodger Stadium, the population has changed dramatically over the last many years. And it's now I think overwhelmingly Latino, and now many Asian people come to the games. And in spite of that, they seem to, they argue, well, baseball shouldn't be political. This is part of tradition and that we should just go. And for those of us who have a critique of Trump that says, if he's not fascist, he's fascist light. This would be like saying, well, let's just go to the visit to Adolf Hitler and receive our award. Soccer is not political. And I think we have to make a statement that this is not acceptable, that these players make lots of money because the fans of Los Angeles support them, and they have some responsibility. I think a great deal of responsibility to the people of Los Angeles. So, I mean, I could go on and on.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
well, how can people join in the campaign and support your efforts to make this call?
Well, number one, I think people need to contact the Dodgers directly. As someone who has tried to do that, it's a little bit difficult. But if you go to the Dodger website, you can reach out and send emails. I think if people want to go to Dodger Stadium with picket signs that say no White House, I think that would be very powerful. I think just as people do chants at the Dodger game, I think chants like no White House would be very, very powerful. And I think the LA Times, Bill Plachke, has written two very powerful pieces in the last several weeks.
That's great.
And again, they seem to not respond to that. I think if people can figure out ways to contact players directly, I haven't been able to do that, frankly. I've investigated, but maybe I'm looking in the wrong places. But, when you have many African-descended people who are on the Dodgers, either from Central America, South America, an African-American ballplayer like Mookie Betts, you have many Asian ballplayers. I find it ironic that Dave Roberts, who's the manager, a very good manager, and a very good ball player during his time. He's a military brat. His father was in the military, and his father's African American. And here's a White House that's systematically gone after African American, higher military officers and gotten rid of them. And so for him to say, well, this is not about politics. This is all about politics. mm-hmm. and we can't condone this sort of behavior.
Well,
and I just want to add, many, many teams have refused to go to the White House. Many artists have refused to go along with Trump. And so the Dodgers wouldn't be unique in this way. Frankly, they're unique in closing their eyes to what's going on and saying, well, we're going to go anyway.
Well, thank you so much. And I will let you know, though, however, that the Dodgers are playing a home game today, and then they're not home before July 23rd. And in fact, they'll be going to play the Yankees right after the All-Star break. They'll actually be in Metro New York the day of the World Cup final. And their game on that day is actually, let's see if it coincides. Well, I'll try to figure that out in a second. But then they go to Philadelphia, and then they go back to New York. And in between when they're in Philadelphia and they go back to play the Mets in New York, that's when the 23rd hits. So they'll be out of town after today. So get something in today to the Dodgers, but don't. That doesn't mean you can't contact the Dodgers. And, of course, you can express this on social media. Josh Basalt, thank you so much from California Teachers Association, UTLA. I hope you heard my idea about giving the red card to Donald Trump at the Meadowlands. And that's I just think of that beautiful field of people wearing UTLA red at those massive pro-worker, pro-teacher demonstrations in Los Angeles at Gloria Molina Park. It was the most spectacular things I've ever seen in Los Angeles. So solidarity. And thank you, Josh. And let's call upon the Dodgers, our team here in Southern California, to not visit the White House. Thank you, Josh.
Great. Thank you very much.
And now we are joined by Ron Placone, who was a very familiar voice here back on KPFK back in the day when a show that I launched with the host, he was a regular on. I think he appeared on David Feldman's show, too, over the years, but certainly he was a regular on the Jimmy Dore show. And Ron is independent of that project right now, but he is a comic filmmaker and a huge soccer fan. And Ron, welcome back to KPFK Radio.
Alan, good to be on with you. Good to chat with you. Good to catch up with you. And yes, I did. I was listening. I did hear the idea. I don't know if you want to set it up again or if you just want to dive into it, but
yeah,
but I think it's a good one.
Yeah, no, I like it a lot. And it's like, now, you know, the crazy thing is I think the red cards that they have in their pockets are actually a little bigger than the quadrants of an 8.5 by 11. And, you know, I don't know, you know, I know you've been to Europe. And if you're in Europe, you know, if you try to print out, European paper sizes are different than American. And it's almost like if you had
yes.
card stock and it was an 8.5 by 14, it was in that quadrant, you look at these red cards, and it's heavy cardboard stock. But it would be good. We could have a little Mel. We could have a little People's Game logo on it somehow, sort of not impeding the coloration, but clearly seeing the People's Game. And then 80,000 handed out in the Meadowlands. And, you know, the right-winger Malay, Argentinian fans, if Argentina is in the game. The Andy Burnham pro, Andy Burnham English fans, I think, would go for it. And I think if you're a fan of the French national team, you're probably not a huge fan of Le Pen. So I think they would go for it, and hopefully the Spanish mm-hmm. would too. The Spanish government's been quite outspoken in its opposition to U.S. support for Israel so recently. But I think Argentina could be a problem there. But man, I love to see it happen. And yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about viability. I'm that crazy. and I also think it could be. You know, we just got to get the idea online too and get it pumped out there and share it with great influencers like Josh Basalt, David Goldblatt, and Ron Placone. And but branded as the People's Game, because that's a term that's been used. I know it's the name of our podcast, and so if it spreads from here. But also, Mom Donnie did a little video about soccer as the People's Game as he was putting out a rejoinder about the FIFA cost, the cost of the tickets. So it's got the Placone blessing. This is brilliant. But alas, Ron, what do you think about the tournament, your thoughts in general, And we'll end again back on that.
Well, the games yesterday were very, very, very enjoyable to watch. I was disappointed with both results, to tell you the truth, and mostly, well, pretty much exclusively for some political reasons. You know, I didn't have necessarily strong feelings, but, you know, Argentina is to the right now, mm-hmm. and England maybe not necessarily as much, but I am very critical of Harry Kane's choice of a golf partner. So I would
explain that one. I don't think I know that one.
He went golfing with Trump.
Oh God, that's
he was golfing with Trump. Yeah, oh, yeah, he was golfing with Trump. And I try not to, you know, I don't like to judge people based on the way they look. That's not who I am. But I got to say, that guy does have the most like right winger-esque look ever. Like if you put Holland and Harry Kane next to each other and said, and nobody knew who they were, like no one had a clue who they were, and you said, one of these guys went golfing with Trump, guess which one? Let's be honest, 100 out of 100 people are going to guess Harry Kane. No one's going to guess Holland. You know what I mean? Like, he just kind of has that look, like he just got done complaining about immigrants. And apparently those are his politics.
Oh, God. So, you're killing me here. Wow.
At least as far as his golf partner goes, I don't know. He hasn't really necessarily embraced Trumpism as far as I know, but he has embraced his golf partner. So there's that. And I think in times like these, you really need to be very definitive. This is a line in the sand moment.
Yeah.
I was glad the U.S. team lost. I really was, because in times like these, at first I felt a little bad about it. I felt bad because I was like, in times like these, a team like the United States just needs to lose because of what the country is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt a little guilty for feeling that way, because I'm like, these athletes have nothing to do with, with the government, like it's not their fault. But then Trump put his thumb on the scale. He said that this red card call was unfair, even though he didn't know what a red card was or when it should be used. But he knew that it was the wrong call. Then he put his thumb on the scale. And it's also, I see the incredible irony. The player that he put his thumb on the scale for, that player was born in the United States, spent most of his life in London. So, well, Donald Trump is putting his thumb on the scale for this player to play in a game. Simultaneously, he's trying to pass legislation so that people in that person's situation will not be able to be citizens in the future. It's incredible. Like, it really is. Just the cognitive dissonance is incredible. So I was glad the U.S. team lost. It needed to happen. The fact that Belgium mocked Trump afterwards was the chef's kiss.
And I think also I felt my line was that they needed to speak out. There were some Winter Olympians who spoke out. In many respects, the crescendo of public opposition to Trump to date has been around the Minnesota killings that occurred with the ICE effort to invade and conquer and the Twin Cities, as it were. And at that point, Winter Olympic athletes, Americans, spoke out against it. I was looking for that for some of the players, because they made it very unfair. Well, I mean, the idea that the Iranian team would have that imposed upon them, basically an extension of their federation, I think it was really incumbent upon them to speak out. Go ahead, Mel.
I will mention, however, that there was an effort by some of the players to speak out right at the beginning of the tournament.
Mm.
And that one was around the ticket prices.
Oh.
It was the ticket and transit prices. And apparently, I don't think it was Pochettino, but it was one of the coaching staff who is apparently a hardcore Trumper that kind of shut that down. But that was, I think that was maybe in the first week of the tournament or so.
Well, I love Pochettino's Kim Jong-un wear. He wears the same clothes as the North Korean communist dictator. And I don't, Trump, of course, has a soft spot for him. And I don't know where that style decision came from Pochettino. But I think I don't think he has progressive politics, even though everybody says he's a great guy. I was looking for so much more. So, Placon, what do you think? So you'll be pulling for which of these teams now? What one do you think is the best team, the most likely to win? Maybe a little bit as we wrap here. And I'll go back to the red cards in a second. But your thoughts about what's remaining? It's the first time ever in a FIFA Men's World Cup tournament that the top four ranked team in FIFA's ranking are the last four teams in the tournament.
My prediction is, I think, France. If I had to pick one, I'm certainly not an expert, especially compared to your last guest. But as someone who just enjoys the game and has been watching it some, I just think France is kind of playing. I just think they're playing at a level. I think they're going to win this thing. I think that England has a very particular formula that's been working. England has had incredible defense, and they just wear a team out and cut off the lanes and frustrate that team until said team makes mistakes, and then they capitalize it. That's how they beat Norway. That's how they beat Mexico. Both were phenomenal games to watch, by the way. But I was disappointed in both cases. I was rooting for Mexico and I was rooting for Norway. But I think that that formula has served them very well. I don't think it's going to serve them all the way to the finish line. I think Argentina is just going to get outplayed. It's come close a couple times.
Right.
Same with Spain. I kind of think France is going to win it. And, you know, again, I don't have like super strong, leanings as far as who I'd like to see win, but you know, given the world affairs right now, I'm pulling for, you know, I'd rather see France or Spain win it. Although, you know, maybe the England team, you know, I kind of thought it was interesting. Maybe the England team, everybody else is really cool and chill, and then they just have one right winger, you know, at the top of the team, which would be kind of ironic because that means the English team has a lot in common with the Smiths. So,
Morrissey fans will.
Well, let's not count out Jude Bellingham. I mean, I think he's actually been performing way better than Harry Kane. And so, you know, that's something.
Well, you know, actually, you know, there's a shift in the government where the more progressive Labour, not Jeremy Corbyn, but closer to Corbyn, much closer than Keir Starmer, and not a betrayal of the, I don't think Andy Burnham ever would have produced this banning of the left from the Labour Party that Starmer tried to effect, and of course it's come back and bitten Starmer, and then Burnham is saying he wants to end neoliberalism. I don't see him taking steps strong enough to achieve that, but I got to say, he's an Everton fan. We have John Stones, we have Anthony Gordon, Jordan Pickford, and the politics of central Liverpool remain very, very left. And so,
well, don't get me wrong. I mean, yeah, like, don't get me wrong. As far as the people are concerned, I mean, just to you know, piggyback on what you're saying, what's been happening in the UK amidst the people has been very inspirational. The fact that they chased the Nazis out of Birmingham, they chased the Nazis out of Liverpool, and that happened not just in England, but it was, you know, triggered all around the world. And there were, well, not all around the world, but all around Europe at least. And there were actions in Rome, and there were actions in Belfast. I mean, that was an incredible weekend, you know, when the Nazis showed up and people all around Europe said, nope, not in our cities, not in our neighborhoods. You know, and a lot of that, you know, really started with, you know, I said Birmingham. I misspoke there. Brighton. There were actions in Birmingham, too. But the main one where it all kind of started was Brighton. And that was beautiful. And it was beautiful everywhere. And seeing that footage was just inspirational. So yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not trying to overlook any of that.
So Ron, will you join Mel and I with our little, like, we'll get a little, like, we'll be at, like, an assembly line, and we'll get old card cutters, and we're going to get these. I think they have little rounded edges. That's going to be a little tough. But, cards, right. And get 80,000 printed for the Meadowlands, and then, you know, spread them around the world, spread the idea. Hey, it's great to talk to you, Ron Polcone. We're out of time here. I apologize for the top of the hour, a little bit of technological problems here at KPFK Radio in terms of connecting to a guest across the pond. I apologize that it's all on my fault. I want to thank our board operator. I want to thank Melissa Figueroa and Ron Polcone. I'll talk to you in the next few days, and thank you for joining us. And
thanks for having me.
Ron, anything you want to say about where you're appearing around town or anything like that? You
know? Yeah, sure. So on July 25th, we are having an actual anti-fascist pasta party, complete with comedy, music, and pasta. And also ronplacone.com. I'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe, and you can catch my movie Left at Wall.
There we go. Thank you. Melissa Figueroa, thank you so much.
Yeah, Josh just texted us with the number for the Dodgers. If listeners,
yeah, 5 seconds.
Join in on that effort. It's 866 Dodgers.
There we go.
Extension 9.
Thank you, Fernando Romero. Thank you.